Talk given Sunday, 15th of June, 1975. Giving and listening to talks like those which we have here has certain heavy responsibilities attached. As you all know, some of the things said are so radical that in actual fact they are very shattering. The tendency of the psyche of those who are unable to take such statements is to shrink from the statements or just push them aside altogether out of self-protection, as we commonly say. In the old days, there was the very definite relationship between the one who was the teacher and those few, the five or six or so, who were the disciples, intimate disciples. But in every case, the relationship between teacher and disciple was a very close, a constant, and an intimate one. That was easy enough under the prevailing conditions, whether in Egypt or in Iran or in other Semitic lands or in India or in China. Today, in our own day and age, such things are hardly possible. Such a relationship is hardly possible, excepting perhaps for very short periods at a time, a week or a fortnight or whatever it may be. In the old case, it was a lifelong relationship. As you know, there are things I say which, if truly understood, would completely disrupt your old way of life. Essentially, with regard to your own inner life, your approach to everyday living, and even in certain cases, your outer life professionally, your breadwinning life, and certainly your social life and behavior. Now, I'm sure you all understand that I say these things not in the manner in which the intellectualist enfant terrible says shattering, radical things. For him, for his listeners, it is an indulgence, it is fun. So interesting, oh, he's so refreshing, so amusing, and all that nonsense. We are not concerned with that at all. We are concerned with the reality of life, with the very, very serious business of understanding the meaning and purpose of our individual existence, to understand the trends of life and growth, to put ourselves in line with those trends, and let there emerge a true flowering. Now please note, I did not say your flowering, but a true flowering. And in this connection today, let us consider this phrase which I have used through the years, the one total reality. We hear this phrase, but how much of it do we really understand? We all know the ordinary dictionary meaning of the words one and total and reality. Or at least we imagine that we do. But how much of it do we really understand? Because in this context of life, and particularly in the context of the living of the holy life, to understand means essentially to become and to be that which is understood. The one total reality. If you really understand that, it will completely alter your whole way of life, inward particularly, and also outward. What is its one of its, what is one of its principal implications? Our ordinary experience in life, our observation through our senses and so forth, makes us see the world as a collection of innumerable particulars. The fact is that there is only one total reality manifested to us as so many countless particulars. We are conscious of the one total realities as one total reality as the many. There is no actual philosophical problem at all regarding the one and the many. The one is cognized, experienced as the many by us because we are what we are, because we are limited in our power of cognition, in our power of being aware. Should our power of being aware come to its full fruition, which means that each one of us is the mature, perfected representative of the word man, then we will be aware of the particulars as the particulars, and at the same time there would be the overriding awareness of the one total reality, which is embodied in each one of these particulars. And each particular in itself represents and manifests the total reality. Now, this may be very acceptable and agreeable intellectually, and it may give intellectual pleasure. Or one may discard it, one may argue about it, and so forth. All that discussion and argument is useless. It's chaff. Here is a simple fact. The one is the many, the many constitute the one. And there is complete and total interrelationship between all the particulars that constitute the many, between each one of them and every other one of them, and the totality itself. The whole thing, from the point of view of sense observation and what we commonly call intelligent perception, is a paradox. But the paradox is the truth of the matter. Now, what is its tremendous implication for us as individuals? We live and function in terms of I and you. I and the object. I and the situation. This is at the very root of our inner awareness. All the time we are functioning in terms of this separation, the I and the you. This I to us is a reality. But this I is a misconcept, which you and I are individually responsible for setting up in this particular manifestation of the one total reality, which is called a man. The I am I concept is a misconcept altogether. Unfortunately, it doesn't remain merely as a concept in our mental rag bag, which contains such a jumbled heap of concepts. This particular concept is the living devil, the living canker, which is in deep in our consciousness itself and determines the shape and the movement of our whole life. Therefore, we may imagine that because we have studied Buddhism or claim to be Buddhists, or because we have studied this, that or the other system or philosophy and claim to be followers of this, that or the other saint or whoever it is and so forth, we are free from its ill effects. We are not. Every one of us, deep in his unconscious, is motivated by winning a goal for himself. There is a nirvana to be attained by me, for me. There is a kingdom of heaven to be realized, which I shall get into if I live the good Christian life and am absolved from my sins, and then I shall enjoy everlasting fellowship with the company of saints in heaven, with God the Father presiding, permanent president. And so forth, and so forth. Your Hindu, your Vedantist will turn around and say, oh, of course, we don't believe all that childish stuff. We, when we have realized the Atma, and then he wonders what on earth he's going to do when he has realized the Atma. He suddenly comes to a full stop. Oh, then there'll be everlasting happiness. Exactly. For whom? Me. This is a very serious matter. It is this which lies at the heart of the misery, the sorrow of the world. The utter ill-doing of the world stems from this idea that there is something for me, ultimately. There is nothing for me. You will say, then are all the teachings, admittedly some of them are little less intelligent than the others, but are all the teachings of all the religions false? They all promise you a nirvana, a heaven hereafter, or of course if you're bad, the other place, and so forth and so forth. Are they all false? Those are the words which are ascribed to the great teachers. Quite probably, they did use such words or similar words. Well, what did they mean by what they said? The Buddha, for instance, said, affirmed positively, there is a beyond. Before he said that, he said that these people falsely accused me of affirming that there is nothing beyond. He points out that he is not a nihilist. That there is a beyond. He affirmed the transcendent in his particular phraseology, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. He affirmed the reality of the extinction of dukkha and the realization of nirvana. All the other great religions do the same. In their own particular way, whether it be Hindu, Zarathustrian, Islamic, Judaic, Christian, whatever the religion may be, they all made similar affirmations. The Upanishads are full of affirmations that when you have transcended all desire, then it is immortality that you find. Immortality that you find. Religions like Hinduism and Buddhism have pointed out realization here. Yajnavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka says positively, whilst we are here, we may know this. Those who do not realize this, sad indeed is their lot. The Buddha says in his very first sermon, hearken because the deathless has been found, going along in the manner which I can show you, you yourselves will realize by your own super knowledge the deathless and abide in it here now. Hinduism and Buddhism give you heaven and perfection and all the rest of it here now. Other religions say, after the body is dead. Now, consider very carefully. If one total reality means that the one manifests as the many, each of the many being changing, constantly changing, becoming different. Where will you find identifiable entity? Persisting identifiable entity. This is the point. This is the crux of the matter. To say that I shall realize nirvana, this, that and the other, is a false statement. The Buddha gives one of the great hints of that when he's talking about Sariputta as he enters the deep states of consciousness, the ultimate stage where you enter that cessation, in which he says, you touch nirvana with the body, the living body. But he says that of every stage, there is no consciousness in Sariputta that I have entered that state and that I am emerging out of that state. This entity I, this identifiable entity I, is completely out. Now, do we practice the silas? Practice meditation, mindfulness, try to bring about a release of panya, insight, realize the complete freedom from all the cankers with the I consciousness out. This is a very, very serious question. See, this is where we all fail, where we all fall down. And we pick ourselves up and go along the same road again, the road of the I, which leads to sorrow, to destruction. Now you see why I said that we do not understand the significance, the real significance, and the implications of this simple phrase, the one total reality, whatever it is. We cling to the identifiable entity of any and every changing particular, especially ourselves. We cannot let go our bondage to the ego, to the postulated ego, the misconceived ego. There is a temporary manifestation which for convenience we may regard as the ego. John Smith, who was born on such and such a date, who lived this kind of life, such were his experiences, and then he died on such and such a date. All right, for all ordinary talking purposes, we say that was John Smith. But there came the end of John Smith. And then we go, because we cling to this postulate that he is an identifiable entity forever and ever, then we may manufacture all sorts of doctrines about his continuity after death, his rebirths, and all the rest of the rubbish, which is utter nonsense. Please do think, if you use your brains even, if you are capable of using your brains, that is to say capable in the sense of you are really willing to face truth instead of wanting wishful thinking to be fulfilled, just vain desiring to be fulfilled. If you want the truth, look at this carefully. We do know from our actual experience here now, limited as it is, short as our perceptions are, dark as our intelligence is, we do perceive that there is nothing which stays put. There is a continuous changing going on all the time. So there is no such thing as the persistence of identifiable entity. A particular man, all right, for the 70, 80, 100 years he lives, we may say, oh, yes, that man is John Smith. And we are able to say that simply because we are constantly in touch with him and can identify him. Supposing we all met at school as children, and then somehow, in a mysterious way, we all got scattered into some environment where we are wholly alone, but we lived as ordinary human beings, you know, growing, getting old, and changing in appearance, and so forth, and then we all met at the end of 100 years. Would any of us be able to identify the other fellow? Oh, that was the chap I knew at school. Complete loss of identifiable entity with the changing process. What then is the meaning of these statements by the great teachers and in the great religions about realizing the kingdom of heaven or nirvana or fellowship with God and all the rest of it? This is what I want you really to get hold of, if possible, today. Because there's ample evidence that we haven't got hold of this. The manifested universe is perpetually changing. It manifests phenomena which are named nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, enlightenment, and so forth. It manifests these phenomena. If I purify my mind and heart, and I can say this only in so far as this particular pattern, physical, living, organic pattern, persists for its 60, 70, 100 years, whatever it may be. If I purify my mind and heart, if I develop the capacity to enter these profound states of awareness, of realize insight and so forth, then through this living being, the phenomenon which is called nirvana is manifest. That is all. It is not that I, the person, an entity, have realized nirvana. The one total reality manifests itself, to which is given the name nirvana, and it is able to manifest this phenomenon to which the name nirvana is given, because this fellow has done certain things. That is all. When this fellow is dead, that is the complete end of that. But we always look to it in this possessive sense. Ah, he attained nirvana. He entered parinibbana, never to be reborn again, and all that sort of stuff. Do you get this? That there is a phenomenon which is manifest. The phenomenon belongs to the one total reality. It is a manner in which the one total reality manifests itself. Now, this is a terrible doctrine. I shouldn't call it a doctrine. This is a terrible insight. When you see the truth, it completely shatters everything that you have believed in. All your mental constructs have to burn away completely. They're all false, every one of them. Now, each one of us is part and parcel of a larger whole, mankind. Man constitutes one kingdom on this planet. There is the animal kingdom, there is the vegetable kingdom, there is the mineral kingdom, and so forth. Don't regard them as watertight compartments, but for the convenience of trying to understand, we'll talk of these different kingdoms. We are part and parcel of this particular kingdom, man. In the universal becoming process, the process is not meaningless or senseless. It is a cosmic process. It is not a chaotic process. Using the word chaotic in our modern sense of the words chaos and the adjective chaotic. You see, there is a pattern forming, a pattern which is sustained in such a manner that we observe what we call growth, a developing and a fruiting, a coming to fruition. The trends of life, and life is the omnipotent, the trends of life in the human kingdom work along lines such as these. The development of refinement, of sensitivity, of responsivity, and so on. And these, which I have suggested in very general terms, manifest in the more particular terms of the fruition of intelligence, of insight, of purity of the mind and the heart, and so forth. And the consequence to the living organism, you or I, of this, is an inward happiness, a beauty, a peace, which is of a totally different order of being and consciousness than anything that those words and similar words, love, wisdom, goodness, represent in our everyday world. These are the trends for mankind. They are trends of development, trends of growth. Don't ask me what happens when they have come to fulfillment, fruition, in 1 million or 100 million years, as the case may be. Ask me afterwards, when mankind has reached that stage, then perhaps, if you are good enough, I'll tell you. We must have a little lighter note, you know, in the midst of all this seriousness. Now, such being the trends, and because it is a one total reality, which is pushing and developing in this manner, it is the one total reality that comes to fruition through the particular individual who, having seen what reality is doing, puts himself in line with it and allows this marvelous fruition to come about. And that's all. But it is not yours. That it is not something you can hold as an entity. If you can't see that, and if you cannot abide by the consequences of seeing that, then remain the worldling. Well, you will inevitably remain the worldling in a very subtle and a refined form, true enough. But this is not the context of transcendence. This is not religion in its profoundest sense. The context of transcendence, the context of religion implies that the full purpose of life for mankind does really come to fruition in you and through you. And it can only come to fruition in and through you and in no other way. This is where each one of us is indispensable. This is our infinite worth. This is the reason why Jesus said, "Not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it." You see the significance of becoming unselfed. To be utterly, to realize the selflessness which has to preeminently distinguish us human beings. Otherwise we are selfish in some form or other. We are self-seekers. Now be careful. Don't just change the terminology and say, "Oh, I shall stop seeking God and Nirvana and so forth. I have heard Firoz Mehta pronounce some marvelous truth and I am going to put myself in tune with the trends of life and work for the fulfillment of life." Be very careful. I am going to seek and perceive and put myself in tune with it. No. You might naturally feel impatient and say, well, what the blazes am I to do then? I'll tell you precisely what the blazes you are to do. Neither you nor I can see the matter positively and say positively, "Do this, do that." How many have ever understood that extraordinary thing in the Old Testament? The Lord God tells Moses, "But you will see me, and as I pass by, you will see me. But you will not see my face, but only the back of me." What is the meaning of that? You see, our concept and definition of the positive is absolutely bound by our self-orientedness, our selfishness. Whatsoever draws the world unto me and gives me a result, etc., is the positive thing. Now look at it the other way. What is it that prevents Nirvana from being here, the kingdom of heaven from being here all the time? This, that, and the other obstruction in each one of us. Our mental and moral defilements, our stupidity, our reactivity in terms of violence and ambition and all the things that are evil, the things of the devil. That is what is obstructing. Now, if I see the obstruction, really see the obstruction, and if I cease to oppose it, because then I will be setting up the biggest obstructor, this devil, the I, against it, so the fight will go on forever and ever, and no amen at the end of it. See, that is the wrong way. See the thing with such intensity of seeing that in your innermost consciousness there is no more grasping after that which is obstructive to the ways of transcendence. You won't know, I don't know, how the thing happens actually. but it will happen. When I see that there is selfness, this is selfness, and I have really seen it with complete intensity, then the selfness disappears. And I don't know that it has disappeared. When I enter into the deep states and touch nirvana with the body, I don't know it. It has just happened. Unto God be the glory, as the theists have said. Now do you understand why it is always unto God the glory? Nothing for me. If you can learn that lesson, you will be the saviors of mankind. Nothing for me, nothing whatsoever. What comes from the world into me and through me is the gift of transcendence, of the one total reality. And I don't know its giftness, if I may manufacture that word, because I interpret it in my own evil, stupid, self-centered way. And say that, this is good. Why? Because I like it, because it gives me pleasure. Let it give me displeasure, and I may reach the point where I can curse God, can't I? Haven't we all done it sometime or other? No. The one total reality comes to fruition. I cannot dare to say that these are the clear lines, the positive lines and the positive approach. I can only say this is the ill in me, and I can see that ill with such intensity that at last the good is there. This, the living organism, the psychophysical organism, has been utterly cleansed. You know how often I have said, you can't sprinkle cleanness in a room. You can only remove the dust and the dirt, and the room is clean. That is how it happens. The stupid man of the world, who imagines himself so practical and hard-headed and intelligent and commonsensical, he is really the fool who says that, this is all very negative. Precisely. He doesn't know that at his best, at his most perfect, he will only see the back of the face of the Lord. He won't see the Lord face to face. He doesn't know it. He demands to see the Lord face to face. See this manifested in a trivial way by all our brilliant journalists who go out, say, to India to explode the myth of the spirituality of the guru and this, that and the other. First, they should go to Aphrodite and demand that she ungirdle herself and see what happens to him. And then, if he still has any sensitivity left or any life left, he will begin to be sensible and not demand to see the guru and disclose to him matters spiritual. Can you show the Kohinoor to anyone who was born blind and is not cured of his blindness? That is what all these people try to do. When they go in that spirit, demanding, the aggressive demand from within. Why such an aggressive demand? At the back of that person, as it is with practically all human beings. There is the motivation by the belief of oneself as a permanent, identifiable entity, unchanging entity. But now, what is the consequence of seeing this? Even with one's brains, leave alone seeing it with one's whole heart, what is the consequence of seeing this? It is the end of self-seeking, is it not? You can't seek for yourself anymore. And not only is it the end of self-seeking, in the sense that it is the end of seeking for just myself, John Smith. It is the end of seeking for those whom you love, as we say, your family, your friends, your society, the cause you serve, your nation, mankind, God. The extraordinary conceit and stupidity of serving God as if they knew God. How can you serve that which you don't know? You see what a extraordinarily tragic self-identification this is. This is egoism in its supreme state. And we all do it. Well-meaningly. As we say ordinarily, the heart is good, but the head is so appallingly stupid and the hand so appallingly clumsy that we make a hell of a mess of heaven. Now, look, I'm fierce today about all this, and I mean to be fierce. Because time is short. It's running out very rapidly. Not for you youngsters, but if we here really understand and really undergo this transformation, this burden just falls off our shoulders. We cling to it, this burden of selfness. You find then that the mind and the heart naturally become clean and pure. You find intelligence beginning to function by itself. You don't have to strive for the functioning of intelligence. You have only to see the actual stupidity inside, and that stupidity gives way to intelligence, to insight. The few of us who are gathered together like this, what happens if that, what is the consequence when that happens to each one of us? Each one of us becomes a living center into which transcendent energies constantly pour and freely move out again, affecting our total environment. We do not know how this happens. And the way to spoil it happening, the first way, is to want to know the result. How will this happen and take place? The question must not be asked. It's the question of the man who is self-concerned and self-centered, who is selfish. It is not the question of the one who is unselfish. The one who is unselfed, like the sun, just shines naturally. And he doesn't know that he is shining. with the light of heaven in his eyes. He doesn't know it, but it is there. Everybody else gets affected by it. Those of you who are so deeply interested in Buddhism and so forth, have you ever tried to penetrate into this peculiar statement you come across in the texts? There is somebody, a seeker as we call him, walking about, and he sees one of the great disciples of the Buddha, and he says, "Friend, your countenance is clear and shining. Your faculties are so obviously developed. Who is your teacher and what does he teach?" The light of heaven shines in their eyes. Doesn't it? These are not idle phrases. They have deep significance and meaning. So each one of us, as a center, into whom transcendent energies pour and move out unobstructed, quite free, such centers are the influence which will transform the world in the right way. In the right way. It will certainly not solve any economic and political problems or social injustices, as we call them, and so forth. What solution, what resolution it brings about in those spheres is something which we, with the worldly eye, will not acknowledge as the right way. Because when we look with the worldly eye, when we are aware with the worldly consciousness, we are aware with all the wrong criteria and values and judgments and so on. Our perceptions are vitiated from the beginning. We have no trust in reality, in truth. We have no trust in transcendence. We pretend we have. And I tell you why I say this, that we have no trust. Because we bring our conceptions to bear upon any feeling that we trust, and thereby spoil the feeling. Why do you shut your eyes when you are with the Beloved? Why don't you scan the Beloved critically? You don't do it, do you? Why do you shut your eyes? You shut out self and give yourself like that. This is the nature of love, of truth, of beauty. This is how transcendence functions. Don't ask for results, then. Don't ask to see what happens. Yours is the task of being pure in mind and heart. The simple sealers do not harm or hurt anything. Do not grasp at anything whatsoever. Let go whatever the consequences. Be utterly truthful. Let speech be pure, clean, not malicious, not slanderous, not gossipy. Oh, I've talked about speech and shutting up times out of number. But do you shut up? Or do you come barging into the room, shouting out loudly all that happened to you, or etc., etc., as if anybody in the world cares a tuppenny damn about what happened during the day? Interrupting a person who may be listening to the news with utterly uncalled for and unnecessary comments, which really are a pestilential nuisance. This is the kind of way we behave in actual fact. This is what actually happens. And if this is what actually happens, after years and years of going to societies and meetings and sessions and sockings and goodness knows what of sit-ins, you see, the whole thing is a humbug. We are a lot of humbugs. When we see that, then the humbugginess will be out.
We only serve our beliefs, not our God.
No, but this is really important. You won't get any revelation by listening to me or anybody. You have to become the living revelation. And it is transcendence which functions as the living revelation through you, the temporary manifestation of the one total reality, if you have done your task from within yourself of purification. And abide by it. You all listen wonderfully here, absolutely still, silent, quiet, serious. I know that that it is love that binds us all together as a group whilst we are here. What happens to that love? What happens to that intelligence and that goodness the moment we go out? You see, it is harmful almost to be charged up with spiritual energy because we explode outside. This is why the old people kept all this esoteric. And as the years passed and they saw the person grow in the right way, then they were able to just say a few words in the morning, each morning, that was quite enough, a sentence, a phrase, and that was the manna for that day, the manna from heaven. I wonder how many Jews know about that manna. But we can't do that sort of thing in these days. The conditions don't allow us. But I do beg of you, don't merely think about this. Don't, and for God's sake, don't go and argue about it or discuss it. Or find out, what did Firoz mean when he said? If you haven't seen it already, the other fellow can't tell you. And if he tries to, he probably is a fool. You have to be wise from within yourself. You have to be loving from within yourself. You have to be enlightened from within yourself. Touch nirvana with the body. And remember the first meaning of nirvana. Blown out, extinguished. It is the blowing out, it is the extinguishing of greed, hate, delusion. You can add fear, ambition, and such things if you like. And then nirvana is manifest through you.